Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, where you hear about the business of the casino entertainment industry from the people who make it happen. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we sit down with gaming veteran Andrew Tottenham, the founder of the premier gaming consulting group, Tottenham & Company, to talk about the state of gaming in Europe and elsewhere. The GGB podcast is brought to you by iGamingPlayer.com, the leading affiliate marketing service for land-based and online casinos in North America. Victoria, Victoria, I was born, lucky me, in a land that I love. Andrew Tottenham has dedicated his life to making gaming better. Founder of the British-based consulting group Tottenham & Company, he spent 5 years in the late 80s and early 90s heading up the EMEA group for Caesars Entertainment. More recently, he was the lead negotiator for Las Vegas Sands in its pursuit of an integrated resort in Spain. The client list for Tottenham & Company reads like a who's who of quality gaming companies: MGM Resorts, Rank PLC, Sun International, Kurzner International Resorts, KPMG, Deloitte & Touche, just to name a few. He recently launched the Tottenham Report, European gaming and news and commentary for CDC Gaming Reports. He spoke with me at G2E on his views of gaming in Europe and beyond in October. Andrew Tottenham, thanks for joining us on the podcast. It's good to see you on this side of the pond. We see each other in London once in a while, so I'm glad we could get together here. You know, you've been in the industry as long as I have. You've seen a lot of changes through the years. You know, it seems to me, though, we're at kind of a critical turning point right now. There's so many things going on, but this has kind of happened through the years. Do you feel that way, that this is really different than it has been in the past?
I think, basically, things are cyclical. Mm-hmm. And what we're obviously going through now is the massive expansion of gaming in Asia,
right,
which has you know, enormous potential, and I think still has quite a long ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing in Europe is actually, I think, a backlash against the expansion of gaming that we've seen in the past,
right,
15 years. That is in two areas. One is the expansion of slot machines and VLTs.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, in what is perceived to be an uncontrolled manner, it impacts people's lives. Mm. They don't like it.
Right.
And then we have online gambling as well, which you know, in most countries in Europe is legal in one form or another,
right,
and that brings with it its own challenges. People see again advertising on television. They see sponsorship of football clubs. They just see it everywhere, and
right,
again that is an easy target for the media. It's an easy target for politicians.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the sort of themes that I'm seeing. And, you know, if I think back, these are sort of things that I saw going back 15 years.
Sure.
When it's the same thing that expands, and then
mm-hmm.
the media pays attention to it.
Right.
And then politicians respond to the media, and they do something, and usually they do something that's not particularly well thought out or very sensible. But
right,
that's
right,
what usually happens.
I was just reading this morning about the terrible shooting in Las Vegas, that the guy who did it apparently is a high roller, you know, and had been played video poker, thousands and thousands of dollars in video poker. So the backlash from that could be coming as well.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. I mean, it's an awful event, and
yeah,
it's just, I think it's, you know, it is tragic. You know, obviously, you know, he had his reasons. I can't fathom, but he had his reasons.
Right. So, you were the chief development guy for Caesars for many years in Europe.
Yeah.
I know you looked at many opportunities there, but, you know, for not only Caesars, but other companies did try to, too, and it never worked. There was never an opportunity to build an American-style integrated resort there. Why do you think that didn't happen?
Okay, well, it's two things. I think, I've worked for three major companies,
mm-hmm.
Las Vegas-based companies, the biggest, as it were, on projects,
sure,
and not come to fruition. And there are reasons for that, and some are quite simple. The tax rates in Europe don't support integrated,
right,
resorts;
mm-hmm.
they're just far too high. However, where you do get the concessions from government, and they say, okay, yes, we are going to reduce the taxes, we're going to implement some changes, especially to zoning and planning rules, so that you can get a fast-track implementation. Otherwise, you could be caught up in 10 years of planning and these types of things. It's difficult. I mean, so for Caesars, obviously 2008 had an enormous impact on the company, just as it did its private equity buyout. The company was loaded up with debt. Revenues went down. The consequence of that is there is no money available, and so all projects got cancelled. Las Vegas Sands was a little bit different in that there were certain concessions that Las Vegas Sands was looking for and were not able to achieve. Not the ones reported in the press, but however, that was the reason why Las Vegas Sands pulled out. If you ask in the general sense why it doesn't happen, I think because if you look at the size of these projects, they take many years to come to fruition, and the political cycles are quite short.
Right.
And if you're a politician, there are no votes in expanding gambling. There is in jobs.
Right.
But I think some politicians look at casinos akin to nuclear power plants. Do we want one? You know, do I want to be the person that's championing the jobs and power plants, as it were? So I think there's that. And I think that, you know, when you get elected, it's your first year, you do your big, bold moves. The second year, you sort of do your administrative stuff. Your third and fourth year, it's you're looking forward to the election and you're saying, I don't want to do anything controversial. Mm-hmm. And whether we like it or not, gambling is very controversial.
Yeah.
So unless you've got a champion,
right,
a political champion that's prepared to actually move this thing, really push it through, one, two, you need to get it done early in the political cycle, it's very unlikely to happen. So, but, you know, it still can happen.
Right. Well, we do have one planned anyway at this point for Cyprus.
Yes.
With
yes.
Melco. Do you think they're going to run into any unusual roadblocks there?
I don't think so. I think the government is committed to it. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, all the laws have been sorted out, the regulations mm-hmm. are sorted out. It's really now the whole sort of, you know, going through the planning process, and once you go through that, you know, construction. So it should, nothing's ever plain sailing, but it should be, from here on in, should be fairly...
Right. Yeah. And we've seen just recently in Spain with the Madrid government turning down the Cordish companies for their project.
Yes.
Hard Rock is still on involved in the Barcelona project, so hopefully something will come through.
Yeah. I mean, it's hardly Barcelona, it's actually Tarragona, which
is...
You know,
right,
sort of 70 miles away, but so something there. I think, you know, the Cyprus project, you know, with Hard Rock and with Melco and with Hard Rock in Tarragona, Barcelona, mm-hmm. you know, those could be, you know, something to look forward to, although not of the scale of something that perhaps Las Vegas Sands would have done or Caesars.
Okay, great. Okay. What was the impact of the European Union on gaming in Europe? Everybody has to be apparently approved, you know, through the European government there. And, has that had a big impact? Or
That's not quite accurate. So the European, essentially we are subject to European law.
Mm-hmm.
And European law says a number of things. One is that, it's the Treaty of Rome. Is gambling an economic activity? Clearly it is. Then certain rules apply to that.
Okay.
And the only thing you can do is you can get certain sort of carve-outs because of, shall we say, public interest reasons. And what has happened is that European law is moving very, very slowly. I've been watching this since about the 1980s. How... government monopolies have protected their turf, and they've tried to do it in terms of stifling private operators moving into various areas. I think one of the biggest decisions that impacted was one called the Gambelli decision in the European Court of Justice. I should say, under European law, you can't discriminate on the grounds of nationality, so that's a really important thing. So if I'm a British company and I'm applying for a license in, let's say, pick a country, Greece, and a Greece operator applies, they can't say only Greek operator is allowed to apply. So anybody that's in the European can do it. But this was really important because the decision, the Gambelli decision, said that if you are a state, the state can use tools to restrict gambling in their countries, but those tools must be proportionate, and they must clearly meet the aims of what it is that they're trying to do. So there was a... the state governments are basically saying, well, the reason we have these monopolies is because we want to reduce access to casino gambling, for example, or betting. Gambelli was about betting. Yet, on the other hand, they have state monopolies who are operating these activities and promoting them and expanding, and their annual reports talk about expansion and how much they spend on marketing and the new products they introduce. Well, clearly, one is not the same as the other. If they're trying to reduce access and yet they're trying to grow revenue, that isn't. So this is a bit of a wake-up call for the states. So, but it's been sort of piecemeal and pushing and shoving, and it's taken a long time for countries to get pulled behind that. Some countries, like the UK, are very much the private operator. Other countries are, you know, trying to protect their monopolies, their state monopolies of betting or lottery. Sweden, it's casinos too. And they're trying to stop access from other countries. And the thing that's peeling that open is online gambling, obviously, because it's cross-border.
No question about that. The situation in the UK in the gaming industry has been fluctuating for years. What was it, 10 years ago when they had the categories of small, large, and super large, or whatever the top category was. And that was supposed to, you know, encourage development of some larger casino, not necessarily any greater resort size. But that never really worked. Why did that not really come through?
Well, I think first of all, I would classify them as tiny, not so tiny, and medium size. I wouldn't say there was anything spectacularly large about them. It came about because, I think, if we go back, there was a report into gambling, and it said essentially that ambient gambling, gambling on the high street and in fish and chip shops and things like that, where people get easy access to it, is not a good thing. They should be in more controlled areas in larger venues. That was the first thing the report said. And the Blair government basically came out with a thing to sort of re-regulate gambling and also to take note of the fact that online gambling was happening and was completely unregulated. So they had these three categories, and it all seemed to be going well until the government published its white paper, and then the wheels fell off. The media got hold of it and said, this is just dreadful. There is no... no control, that we're going to have wall-to-wall gambling, that the Americans are going to come over and take over and, you know, just put casinos everywhere. And then it was restricted to 8, 8, and 8. Eight, as I said, tiny, not so tiny, medium-sized casinos. And then, unfortunately, there was a... This was just before an election, and in a period of what they called wash-up, was where they negotiate which bills go through. The Blair government blinked and said, okay, well, we'll negotiate the number down, and as soon as that happened, the Conservative Party said, you're going to get one. And that was going to be Blackpool, and then when it went, because you can't nominate the place under European law, it went to Manchester, and the House of Lords said, we didn't vote for this for Manchester, we voted it for Blackpool, and that was because Blackpool had made a very good case. So it's about the whole politics of it, and I think the big reason was that there was a sort of a committee looking at it, did a lot of work, a lot of good work, I think. But it was a cross-party committee with all, you know, all parties involved, both houses of parliament involved. They worked on it, but they kept it very, very close, and they didn't broadcast all the reasons around it. And when the bill hit parliament, or it was sort of like it hadn't been explained. And, of course, the incumbent industry was not very happy with it because of what it would have done to them, so they started campaigning against it. media picked up on it and it just became an unholy mess. And I was involved, quite heavily involved in that.
Right.
And it was just every day waking up to headline after headline
right.
after headline. And one day you just didn't want to wake up because right. you knew it was just going to be bad.
So it seems things have even gotten worse now with the FOBTs in the betting shops. A good friend of mine, Derek Webb, the inventor of free card poker, is very heavily involved in the anti-FOBT movement,
sure.
And even though he's a gambler himself.
Yep.
Where is that going?
So I think if I look at this, I think the bookmakers have only got themselves to blame.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this peculiar... we have more categories machine in the UK than I think any other country.
Mm-hmm.
We have, you know, A1s, B1s, B2s.
Right. Well, they have those arcades as well
exactly.
on High Street. There.
High Street, and then you've got machines that you're allowed in pubs, and you can't have them here
yeah.
and can't have them there. And I actually remember a committee, government committee, when the gambling bill was
right.
being debated,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about different machine types. And I remember thinking, if an alien came down and listened to this discussion, they would think we're crazy.
Right.
You can have a machine that does this over there, but you can't have it over here.
Right.
But this machine, you can have here and here and here. But that one, no, not that. It just
yeah.
didn't make a lot of sense. But they've got themselves to blame. And I think the reason is I was saying, it's this expansion of gambling on the high street in places where people see it.
Right.
And you're talking about four machines per retail outlet.
Right.
That's what they're allowed. It falls under a category of betting because you're actually betting on an event that's taking place
right.
outside of the bookmaker's
mm-hmm.
Retail outlet. And it was so it was four machines per venue is what was negotiated because otherwise it would be more or less unlimited
right.
numbers of
mm-hmm.
machines. And, you know, we've got, I think, almost 9,000 retail outlets and they've got four each, so 36,000 machines. 2008 happened. Rents on the high street tumbled. The bookmakers moved from the side streets to the high streets. Everybody saw it. And they have been heavily promoting FOBTs.
Mm.
Many betting shops, obviously,
right.
the majority of their profit comes from the machines,
sure.
four machines, not from the betting.
Right.
It's an easy target. And they do, I think, have pushed the envelope a bit too hard. I don't think it's smart. They have... load up machines with a debit card,
right. mm-hmm.
Which I think in any universe is not a good idea.
Right.
And, you know, Derek Webb has done a fabulous job of, you know, he and his team have done a great job of sort of pushing
mm-hmm.
the anti-gambling stance. The bookmakers have not done a very good
right.
job of defending their turf. They should have been on the front foot, not on the back foot.
Right.
And I think where it goes now is they'll be lucky if they get if at the moment the maximum stake is 100,
mm-hmm.
I think if it goes down to 20, they'll be lucky. I think
yeah.
it might even go much lower than that. And that will obviously impact revenues in some respects because it's not so much people go in and bet, you know, £100 off the bat, but
mm-hmm.
it is when they basically it's an electronic roulette game.
Right.
They'll bet lots of chips. When they're winning, they'll bet lots of chips, and that means that obviously the average bet is going to decrease, and if the average bet decreases,
sure.
know,
right.
the revenue per machine decreases.
You've also got a very aggressive gambling commission there that's trying to force the industry to pay for responsible gaming in a much more aggressive manner than any other jurisdiction, as far as I can see, except maybe for Australia.
Yeah, I mean, so some countries have a levy.
Mm-hmm.
I think Switzerland has a levy. Some countries that you know the requirements are pretty tough.
Right.
In the Netherlands and in Austria, if you come more than a certain time number of times per week or per month, they interview you, and they might ask to see your financial statements
mm-hmm.
to make sure you can afford what you're
mm-hmm.
doing. And if you're between, I think, the ages of that depends on you know. Below 24,
mm-hmm.
the legal age of 24, and you come more than once a week, they will interview you because
yeah.
that is probably the age where you're most vulnerable. It's a
right.
period where people
mm-hmm.
go through in their lives where they
okay.
have risky behavior. So to your point, yes, the Gambling Commission is, you know, we've got a new chief executive,
right.
Sally Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
She's thinks the industry should be doing more.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, I was involved in the startup of the charity that actually well, we were just collecting money from the industry for education, research, and treatment. It worked out about 0.7% of revenue, of GGR, which isn't a lot. And the big companies gave, the little ones, many of the little ones didn't. I think it will go to a levy. It will be much more than 0.7%. And, you know, again, it comes down to the industry not keeping their fingers on the pulse as to what's going on. And actually, you know, my view is rather than it be a specific amount that needs to be, you know, that 7% of revenue, percentage of revenue, what it should be, in my view, is have an ambitious target in what you want to achieve in terms of what you want to provide, what kind of research needs to get done, what kind of treatment you want to offer. Have an ambitious target, cost it, your budget, and raise that, as opposed to, oh, we're going to raise this kind of money and your job is to spend it. You know, that doesn't seem to me the right way around. That's the way it's going to go, in my view. It will go definitely.
So let's talk about iGaming. You're involved in a lot of iGaming now across Europe and other countries for that matter. You know, it's been very successful in Europe, but isn't it true that most of the revenue, a majority of the revenue comes from sports betting rather than casino or poker?
Actually, no. It's casino is a big driver. Okay. So betting tends to be the tool of acquisition. But if you look at the big bookmakers, if you look at their annual reports, you'll see they all publish how much comes from casino and how much comes from betting. And it is, in fact, casino, you know, the basically the slot games and the casino games that provide the bulk of the money. Your revenue per customer tends to be higher, the lifetime value of a casino player than a betting player. But you too tend to need both betting and casino on your site to make it more sticky. It's, you know, online gambling, you know, has proved to be, for example, in the UK, it's proved to be very, very successful. It's basically allowed to grow. It has very little restriction on terms of, you know, advertising. Because casinos are small, tax rates are high, you can't afford to advertise on television. It makes no sense. It's far too expensive. Whereas if you're an online gambling company, you know, your market is the whole country. So, you know, television makes sense. And that's why you get sponsorship of soccer teams. That's why you get, I mean, if you watch television in the UK, after about 9 o'clock at night, every single advertisement is online gambling. Again, it's creating a bit of a backlash. We're starting to see that as the people who are anti-gambling have tasted blood in their battle against the bookmakers, they're now turning their sights on the online gambling world, and that will be the next one that I think will be picked on.
I think we saw that in the U.S. when they started, DraftKings started advertising on for DFS, and it was just every commercial at a sporting event was, and it was just overkill, and I think that they got a pretty big backlash.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was here. My in-laws lived in New York, and I was here at the start of the football season, and I was watching my father-in-law watching one of the games, and I could not believe what was going on. Every single break, it was, you know, fantasy sports, this is what you do, this is how you play, you know, so on. And I turned to him and said, this is not going to last. You're taking a stick and pushing it into a hornet's nest here. This is not going to happen. And sure enough, you know, you have aggressive attorneys general, who you know, it's a political, you know, because that is really, it's a political position. They will use that to, you know, further their political careers. And they went after the fantasy sports. I looked at that and thought, if you spend any time in the gambling industry, you will know that things go in cycles. And if you keep pushing too hard, it will come back and bite you.
For sure.
What you really need to do is controlled expansion, putting in the regulatory infrastructure in place to argue we're not gambling, we don't need regulation is, I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. So we have some experience in the U.S. with online gaming, particularly in New Jersey, because they have the full breadth of online gaming there. And, of course, just like you mentioned, in Europe, it's casino that has overtaken poker by a pretty substantial amount. We've also have some anecdotal evidence, anyway, that, that you know it is able to draw new players to the land-based casino. So it's really been a symbiotic relationship rather than a cannibalistic relationship. Have we seen that in Europe, or is this...
Very much so. So, some operators will say, "Oh, the reason our revenues are, we're not doing very well is to do with online gambling." I think that's a lazy excuse. I think there are other things that impact gambling as a whole, and one of them is, your current economic situation. If you look at gambling revenue, and especially casino revenue, and how it fluctuates, it's very much attuned to the the economic environment. So if you look at GDP or something like that, you'll sort of see per capita, you can see how it correlates. What we are seeing, I mean, obviously, as I said, the expansion of gambling, especially machine gambling outside of casinos, impacts casinos, land-based casinos, of course. But what we're seeing is definitely a new customer. The demographic of that customer is different. It skews differently. It skews to a younger customer. And I think, land-based operators, they first went into it and they lost a lot of money.
Right.
And the reason they lost a lot of money is because it's a completely different business.
Mm-hmm.
Land-based casinos are about opening your doors, making sure you've got staff behind your tables, making sure everything's clean, service is good, making sure you've got secure, you've got procedures in place so you're secure. Whereas online is basically, it's a technology and it's a marketing business.
Mm-hmm.
It's those two things foremost.
Right.
And companies went in, lost their shirts, withdrew. Online gambling companies who were unregulated basically moved in, were in and expanded and could move very, very rapidly because they were unregulated, didn't have a regulator to answer to, and were very innovative and really started to push the envelope as to that. And I think it's now companies are starting to look seriously at the online sector and rank. They have a new chief executive, relatively new, Henry Birch. Henry has background is online, and his mantra is, we're in the land-based gambling business. We should be in the online gambling business. And if you look at the size of the market in the UK, it's online is bigger than land-based.
Sure.
So okay, it's highly competitive, but it's a great space to be in if you've got some scale.
Okay, great. Well, Andrew, thank you for sitting down. I could talk all day, but I know you've got places to go. It's good to see you here at G2E, and then let's catch up again when we get to England in February for ICE.
Okay. Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of the GGV Podcast, brought to you by iGamingPlayer.com, the leading affiliate marketing service for land-based and online casinos in North America. To learn more about the gaming industry, visit GGBMagazine.com, or for a weekly update, visit GGBNews.com. Follow us on Twitter at Global Gaming Biz, or on LinkedIn and Facebook at Global Gaming Business Magazine. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week on the Global Gaming Business Podcast.